This week on the show, Mike Reese of ESPN Boston joins us to recap the Patriots' most recent draft, Craig Sidon of Snap Call Sports on what's been a wild NHL playoffs, and look back at the career of one of the best NBA players of the last decade. All of that and more coming up. Calling It starts right now. Welcome into another episode of Calling It. Alex Barth here once again. NFL Draft is behind us. On the phone with us now to help break it down, he covers the Patriots for ESPN and knows more about football than just about anybody out there. Mike Reese, how's it going, Mike?
I'm doing great. Always fun after a draft, even though the Patriots sort of felt like they sat this one out, right? I mean, not a lot of moves to talk about.
Four picks, the fewest in franchise history. It must be nice for you on a day like today to kind of take a deep breath. You do all that draft prep, and now very limited sample for you to have to go through and analyze.
It was a rare breather, but, you know, part of me feels like we were rewarded for all the free agent moves they had in March, where it was like every day it seemed like there was another move that they made. So maybe this is the flip side of it, because they were so active back in March in free agency with their signings and their trades. They were a little bit quieter in the draft.
So let's start there. I've heard a lot of people say, and even the Patriots themselves, they tweeted out that their first round pick was Brandon Cooks. They drafted Mike Gillisley in the fifth round. I've even seen people go as far as to say they took Garoppolo 12th overall by not trading him. Is it fair in your estimation to say that, you know, to count Brandon Cooks as the Patriots' first round draft pick this year, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, that's absolutely fair as I see it. I mean, because what did they do? They gave up the number 32 overall pick for him. So, I mean, how would you not say that, right? I think the key thing, though, to look at with that is it's a little bit different when you draft a guy versus trade for a player with that pick. And when I say that, the biggest difference is that when you draft a guy at 32 overall, you're signing him to a contract that's going to be 4 years in length with the opportunity to be 5 years in length. And those are usually at pretty good affordable rates. Brandon Cooks, you have for 2 years, basically $10 million. So there is a trade-off there. While they're getting probably a better player than they would have drafted at 32, they're only getting that player right now for 2 years, and they have to pay $10 million over those 2 years. So a little bit more of a cost the Patriots have to pay to the player in Cooks.
A short-term approach from Belichick, something we don't really often see from him. Were you surprised when they picked up his option this weekend?
Oh, not at all. So basically, once they traded the first-round pick for him, I mean, you figure that's a slam dunk. They're not going to trade a one, Alex, for a guy that they only had under contract for 1 year. So to me, that wasn't a surprise. What I'm really focusing on now is, can they extend that deal out even further? Because you could make the case that trading the 32nd overall pick for a player that you only have for 2 years maybe isn't smart business. You know, I mean, let's see what happens over those 2 years. I suppose if they win two Super Bowls and Brandon Cooks plays a big role in both Super Bowls, I could come back and probably say, did I really say that? But right, you know, but you really want to extend that out another 3-4 years, you know, on top of the 2 years that you have them for.
So now on to the picks the Patriots did make, and we're all waiting. What was it, Friday night, 72s getting closer, 10 picks away, 5 picks away, and they moved down. They did it a couple of times in this draft, but at 72 with their first pick, do you think that was more a case of there was nobody they wanted on the board they valued at 72, or there were so many guys on the board that they felt like they could trade down to 82, still get a good player, and pick up an extra pick?
So there's two different scenarios to consider with this, and oftentimes when they trade down, it's that they feel like they can get the same caliber of player in the spot they traded to while picking up an asset in return for moving down. So that's scenario one. Scenario two is that they're ready to pick a guy at 72, and the pick or two before that, their target, the guy they really wanted, goes off the board, and they're sort of forced to adjust.
Which do you, so you believe it was the second one in this case?
I do, Alex. I think they were looking at either a defensive end or an interior. offensive linemen. If you look at the four picks right before, you know, where they were going to pick at 72, I looked at a couple of those guys and they look like Patriot type players that I could envision them, you know, thinking could help them and help them pretty quickly. Those guys go off the board. And to me, this is just instinct now. I don't know this for sure. I'm thinking they probably say, all right, let's move it down. Let's regroup here, get ourselves together and see what our next target might be.
And they end up with Derek Rivers, a defensive end or outside linebacker, an edge rusher from Youngstown State. I first saw his tape back in March. And the guy that he's looked like to me, and it's easy to say this was the Patriots, was Jamie Collins. Not as good, but raw athlete, a guy that can go from being just a big body to a football player. Do you see Collins being a comp for Rivers, or is there another guy you think would be a better comparison?
So the first thing that I think about when I hear about Jamie Collins is like this freak athlete, right? Like this guy that's like broad jumps record at the combine and like just oozes athleticism. And you're like, wow, you know, we could do a lot of different things with him. So I don't necessarily see that with Derek Rivers from like, he's a good athlete, but like Jamie Collins was like an off the charts
right
athlete like that. So I don't think this is an off the charts athlete per se, but what I think Derek Rivers is like a good pass rusher. So when I think of a player, you know, that might be a comp, it's like a guy that, you know, you're going to want in your sub packages. Like maybe, you know, I hadn't really thought too much about it, but you know, think about a defensive end that you want to play going forward, maybe not necessarily off the line of scrimmage like Jamie Collins was, but on the line of scrimmage and at defensive end, like a Rob Ninkovich type of player. But, you know, this guy's got some quick twitch type, you know, athleticism to him. So think pass rusher. To me, that would be sort of 41 career sacks at Youngstown. That's a school record. To me, that's sort of the comp I would make. And I'm trying to think of something off the top of my head of a player, you know, that I'd look at and say, like a Tully Bantakane going way back. He was a little bit of a later yep. pick, but a guy that's a outside linebacker, defensive end, tweener type that can get after the quarterback.
So do you see Rivers being more of a stand-up guy for them or a hand-down on the line guy? And if he is going to be hand-down, do you think he needs to put on some weight, bulk up a bit?
So, you know, to me, he can be both. I mean, you in this system, you can be a stand-up guy and still be playing on the end of the line of scrimmage. So if you're in your 3-4 defense, you know, your end-of-the-line player is your outside linebacker, and that could be Rivers. And if you're in a 4-3, you know, he could be at the, you know, the end of the line of scrimmage as an end. So I think he could be technically both. To me, like, let's see what he does when he gets here in terms of looking at his weight. Ideally, you want him to put on weight. This is what Phil Savage, the executive director of the Senior Bowl, had told me. He said, look, anytime a guy is coming from Youngstown State, you know he needs to hit the weight room a little bit more. I mean, that's not that uncommon. That's not that uncommon, though, for really any prospect coming in. So I think Rivers right now is at about 245, 247. I mean, he should be able to get up to 250, 255. But what you want to be careful of, Alex, is if he puts on the weight, does that compromise him in the, you know, athleticism, the ability to get to the quarterback? So they'll figure that out when he gets here. I think the way they're in sub packages these days, you know, with five or more defensive backs, they can do a lot of different things with Rivers. I don't think we need to pigeonhole him into one spot or the other.
They're moving on to their second pick now. They took Anthony Garcia. They took another tackle later in Connor McDermott. And a lot has been made about Nate Solder's contract situation. He's up at the end of the year. Although last year it felt like to me that the Patriots didn't really have that third tackle. In a lot of their successful seasons, they've had a third swing tackle, guy who can go to either side. Right now it's Cameron Fleming. Adrian Waddle might be in the mix. Are these guys, were these picks made with a third swing tackle in mind or with Nate Solder maybe being on the way out in mind?
Probably both, right? And so an interesting point that you make on the swing tackle, and that might be right on the money. Cameron Fleming, if we recall, stepped in at left tackle in the season opener last year in Arizona for Nate Solder, and, you know, he played pretty well. But I think your point is well taken, though, because that's one game, right? Cameron Fleming also played in week 5 at Cleveland at right tackle for Marcus Cannon and played very well, but that's one game. Like, what if you had to rely on him for 16 at either of those spots? And that might be the team's thinking here is, let's see if we can upgrade that with the bigger picture in mind. Yeah, we know we got a guy that can do it for a game or two, but do we have a guy that can do it for 16 if we needed him in the event of the catastrophic, you know, season-ending injury? And so Garcia's interesting in that he's an athletic left tackle, really fits the Patriots system in terms of footwork and athleticism. He's not like one of these big mauling type tackles that might fit a different type of system than the Patriots run. He's more of an athlete. And I always say with these offensive linemen, you put him in the Dante Scarnecchia school of offensive linemen. And he really graduates a lot of impressive linemen, and they can come out of nowhere from small schools like Troy, where Garcia went, to the bigger schools, from the practice squad, you know, to the D1 school. So I think swing tackle is part of it, but I also think Nate Solder is going to be an unrestricted free agent after the 2017 season, and that's a premium position where if you're going to sign a guy, you're probably going to be paying some big money. And the Patriots, as we know, always like to give themselves leverage in those type of situations. And the pick of Garcia, and later perhaps with Connor McDermott late in the sixth round, they traded up for him, could be made with that in mind as well.
And with only four picks, a lot of undrafted guys coming in. And first of all, you did a fantastic job covering that over the weekend. It always seems to be the undrafted guys. I won't find out a guy signed sometimes till, you know, training camp. But you guys had a very comprehensive list, so kudos to you. Austin Carr was the big name for me. I really liked that. I was surprised he didn't get drafted. Kind of like what we just talked about with Solder. Julian Edelman's contract is up soon. He's going to be in his 30s, similar to Wes Welker when he was on his way out. Is this a guy similar to Edelman they maybe stash for a year or two and then can really fit right into that slot receiver role that's so crucial for this team?
It's certainly possible. You know, I think the one thing that stands out to me on all these guys, whether it's him or it's a guy like a linebacker from BYU, Harvey Longy, I mean, it's like the Patriots, they put their money where their mouth is in terms of you come to the Patriots as an undrafted free agent and we're going to tell you, you have a chance to make this team. Like, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a first round pick or an undrafted guy. We do it on a meritocracy here. It's not about draft status. And what better example is there than Malcolm Butler in 2014, right? I mean, he wasn't even an undrafted signing right after the draft. He had to come in on a tryout a week later, you know, and they keep him on the roster because he's making plays in practice and he showed promise. So, you know, and go down the line, David Andrews, the center. Last year in the Super Bowl, it was Jonathan Jones, an undrafted free agent who was playing for the Patriots. Well, their top draft pick last year, Cyrus Jones, was inactive for the game. So, you know, Austin Carr, you mentioned the name, wide receiver, Northwestern. What I would say is that if he comes in and performs well and shows he could be that guy for, you know, next year for Julian Edelman, the Patriots won't hesitate to keep him because they're always thinking not just for this year, but the year after and beyond.
Again, we're talking with Mike Reese. He covers the Patriots for ESPN. The draft is behind us. Training camp not till the end of July. Kind of the quietest time of year, if there is a quiet time of the year for the NFL. Mike, what's the biggest storyline between now and when camp opens you have your eye on for the Patriots?
Well, I got to give you a couple. I can't narrow it down to one.
All right.
I love this stuff too much.
Value
right?
picks, right? Give me all the value you got. We're talking Patriots. Got to be about value.
I love it. So let's see if they bring in a experienced center to compete with David Andrews. You know, you and I have talked about this in this interview about how they're always thinking ahead. David Andrews, if he had an injury at center, do the Patriots feel like they have someone there that could get them through a full 16-game season? I want to see that. And also, you know, he's entering a restricted free agent year, David Andrews. And so similar situation as Solder, you know, Patriots might want to protect themselves with that in mind. So that's one spot I'd look at. I want to know if Jason McCourty, the brother of Devin McCourty, free agent cornerback, would he consider signing here? They look pretty deep at corner, so I'm not sure if he'll feel it's the right opportunity for him. But I want to see if that happens. And then I want to give you something fun, Alex. Like, I okay. love this stuff so much. Like, I want to know what jersey number Brandon Cooks, Mike Gillisley, Coney Ealy, Dwayne Allen, all these new guys that they brought in, I want to know what numbers they're wearing, because this is part of the fun of covering a team, right? Like, Mike, I mean, it's all nooks and crannies of it. So I'm going to take you from all different angles here.
Thank you so much for that jersey one, because I was talking to my brother about that last night. He goes, what do you care? They're going to play. I love the jersey numbers. I love exactly. the jersey numbers and what kind of helmet are the guys going to use. Always fascinates
love
me.
Love it. Love it.
One last thing here before we let you go real quick. Patriots Hall of Fame ballot is out right now. Mike Vrabel, Richard Seymour, Raymond Claiborne, who has your vote?
Ooh. Well, I feel like this is going to be a little bit of a political answer, as okay. the Hall of Fame process often is political. I really feel like all three deserve it. Okay? So, like, to me, it's like, it's not like one should get in and the other two shouldn't. So it's just a matter of timing, like who gets in first. And I've voted for all three in my time with the Hall of Fame. And I think I'll tell you who I think is going to get in. I think it's going to be Richard Seymour. It's yep. his first year of eligibility. And I think of the three players, he's the best player of the three. Like, I think he, you know, is like he was a dominant player when he was at his best. I think Mike Vrabel, in terms of what it meant to be a Patriot, like versatility, catching touchdowns as a tight end, playing hurt, playing out of position. Like, to me, that's a Patriots Hall of Famer. And then you go back to Raymond Claiborne, late 70s into the 80s. Like, he did it longer than those two guys. So, and he played at a high level next to Mike Haynes, so, you know, who's arguably the best cornerback the Patriots have ever had. So, like, honestly, flip a coin, take your pick. I think Seymour is going to be the pick this year because he was probably the best player of the three. But, Alex, what I'd say is you couldn't go wrong with any of the three.
Seymour is my vote just because with Vrabel, we're to get awkward with his coaching responsibilities elsewhere. You see the guys who get in normally around the whole year. Obviously, it would be tough with Mike Vrabel. Mike Reese, you can follow him on Twitter, at Mike Reese, does a fantastic job covering the Patriots. Hopefully, we hear from you again around training camp or, you know, who knows with the Patriots. Maybe something breaks in the next couple months. Thanks for coming on, Mike.
Alex, thanks for having me. And let me just add one last thing on the Vrabel thing. Let me just give you this sort of fun possibility.
Hit me with it.
So the Patriots host the Texans in week 3 this year. 1 o'clock game on a Sunday. Like, you could actually make this a fun weekend where, you know, Vrabel's coming in with his team. He's he's the defensive coordinator yep. with Houston. You could have the ceremony that Saturday before the game. He's already in town, and you could have some fun with that. And then the next day during the game, you could acknowledge it to the crowd at the game. Just throwing it out as a scenario that could be fun if Vrabel ultimately is the choice.
Honor him and then rip his defense apart the next day. I love it, Mike.
Well said. You're sharp.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Hey, thanks for coming on again. Mike Reese, read him on ESPN. Fantastic stuff.
Thanks for having me.
Colin, it is a Snap Call Sports production. Snap Call Sports is available for iPhone or Android download. Snap Call. The game within the game.
Welcome back to Calling It. Alex Barth with you. NHL playoffs moving through into the second round, well into the second round. It's been a heck of a series so far, a heck of a set of series. With us on the phone from Snap Call Sports and the New Jersey Devils is Craig Seiden. Craig, how you doing today?
Doing great, Alex. How are you?
I'm good. I've been enjoying a lot of great hockey. A lot of unexpected hockey to me. A few things that I did not think would happen so far. You did the Nashville sweep. You had Ottawa move on. What's been the biggest surprise for you so far in this playoffs?
I would have to say the Nashville sweep would probably be the biggest surprise of the playoffs so far. You have the Hawks and the Blackhawks who come in as one of the heavy favorites and go out in four straight games. The other biggest surprise would be the Minnesota Wild. You have the two top teams in the West go out in the first round who barely put up a fight. Chicago in 4 and Minnesota in 5. Both teams with over 100 points coming second and third in in the top five in the overall standings and go out right in the first round. That to me was the biggest surprise, and I could see moves coming within those organizations come the offseason, major changes for both teams.
And I want to touch on that in a bit, but let's stay with those teams that are still alive right now. And the two that beat Minnesota, Chicago, facing off against each other in Nashville and St. Louis. Jake Allen has introduced himself to the world, I think, in this playoffs. Nashville's given themselves a new look. It's been my favorite series to watch, at least so far. What is Nashville? We'll start with them. What are they doing right now that they've been able to get this hot at this point?
Well, as you know, with any playoff system, it's about getting hot at the right time. You know, they came in, you know, winning winning on a little bit of a hot streak and firing on all cylinders. But I think the biggest thing for them right now is their defense, especially Ryan Ellis. He has a 6-game point streak during these playoffs, including 8 points during that, including a goal yesterday from the top of the point to give them a 2-goal lead. So that was one thing that's really helped. They've factored into the scoring of about, you know, every game this postseason, and they love to activate. They have two of the best, if not the best, offensive defensemen in the back end in Roman Josi and PK Subban. And Pekarina is finally looking like the goaltender we all knew he was, and finally playing like that in the playoffs. The other thing is the top line of Nashville is just so dangerous. You have Victor Arvidsson on the right, Ryan Johansson in the center, and Philip Forsberg on the left. But the big thing for them is depth scoring. You had Cody McLeod put in his first goal yesterday, Colton Sissons the other day. You know, they're getting the depth scoring that you definitely need in the playoffs. And they're rolling all four lines. So, you know, just like Pittsburgh did last year, they rolled four lines and rolled all the way to the cup in six games.
So basically everything they're doing is working. Everything they touch turns to gold. On the other side, you have Jake Allen has been masterful, poetic, shut down, nearly single-handedly shut down Minnesota. He's been good at this series as well. Is he the hottest goaltender in the playoffs right now? And going into the series, who would you take as your goaltender going into a best of seven, Rene or Allen?
I wouldn't say he's the hottest goaltender right now. There are a lot of goaltenders that are playing really well. Cam Talbot in Edmonton, Henrik Lundqvist for the Rangers, Marc-Andre Fleury, who came in relief of Matt Murray after he went down during warmups of Game 1 against Columbus, has stonewalled both Columbus and now Washington, the President's Trophy winners. But I would take Pekarina. I think Marty Brodeur coming in as taking over the role as goalie coach for Jim Corsi midseason has really improved Allen's game. He's made major leaps and bounds. He doesn't let those goals affect him. He turns the page very quickly, which you want to do as a goalie. And he has really kept the Blues within this series, and especially in yesterday's game. They were held to a combined 10 shots through two periods, and were being outshot 29-10 entering the third period. If it really wasn't for Jake Allen, it could have been a whole lot more yesterday and not as close of a game. And that's what you want out of your goaltender. You want them to be your best player on the ice and to keep you in games, and that's exactly what Jake Allen's done. It's just the Blues on the front end haven't produced as many goals as they would like to because of the speed of Nashville.
Talking with Craig Seiden of Snap Call Sports. That series is knotted up at 1-1 in both of those cities, Nashville and St. Louis, not normally hockey hotbeds, but both cities have really caught the fever, especially in Nashville, and it's great to see. Meanwhile, you go north of the border. Ottawa's up 2-0 in their series, but you wouldn't know it. They can't sell out games. People are leaving early. Let's face it, the trap is boring hockey. Is Ottawa's success a problem for the NHL?
No, I don't think it's a problem. If it brings in that Canadian market, which you need.
But even if the people in that market aren't showing up and aren't following the team?
Well, you also have to realize, let's put it in the case of a big market team like New York. The New Jersey Devils were the third team in there. Ottawa is the same case. They came in the early 90s. They were the third team there. You already had Montreal, Toronto. Those are the two biggest names in Canada when it comes to hockey. So it's hard to grow that fan base, but it's growing now, and with long-term success, the fans will show up. Remember, they haven't made it. They've only made it out of the second round a couple times, and one of them they went to the Cup Finals in 2007 and lost to the Ducks in five games. The more success you have, the more likely the fans will come. So I'm not worried. You know, winning breeds fandom. And that's exactly what they're doing. And even though they may be just sitting back and playing that 1-3-1 trap, you know, it's really what the goalies are doing is what is stealing the show. The Craig Anderson story with his wife and the success of the team, and Henrik Lundqvist, who's been playing his best hockey this postseason that he's played all year. He's been up and down all year, especially with a little bit of a goalie controversy with Antti Raanta, his backup. And Lundqvist is showing why he's still late in his 30s, why he's still one of the greatest goalies in the game today.
The Washington Capitals were the best team in the regular season in the NHL. They got even better adding Kevin Shattenkirk at the deadline. They're down 0-2 to perhaps their biggest rival in the Pittsburgh Penguins. This is a team that year in and year out has choked their way out of the playoffs. Some people said it was this year or bust. If they go out to Pittsburgh, especially if they get swept, what kind of changes are we looking at in Washington? Could there be wholesale moves? Is it everybody but Ovechkin? Is even Ovechkin on the table? Do they look to move Holtby? How bad can things get in the nation's capital?
I don't think it's going to get that bad. I think a couple of tweaks there. They're definitely going to lose some players due to free agency over the cap. Cole Eisner is up. Shattenkirk, as we all know. Evgeny Kuznetsov is an RFA, so he's going to need to get paid. So I don't think there are going to be as many changes. I think their style of game needs to change a little bit. They need to add more speed to their game, especially on the back end. You know, you have a Carlson, a Shattenkirk, and a Nate Schmidt, but they don't really have that one big overpowering guy besides Brooks Orpik to punish the Penguins in this series. And the Penguins are just flying by them. Right now, their problem is Braden Holtby. He has let in soft goals all series long, and Washington hasn't been able to slow the Penguins down at all. It's the same story. And I was actually looking at a stat today. The Penguins during the Crosby-Malkin era, when they've gone up 2-0 in a series, are 8-0 in those series. So if the Capitals can make history, if they could make a comeback, but that all starts tonight with this game. They have to take it one game at a time and wear the Penguins down, put the puck in the offensive zone and cycle and wear them down. That's the only way to beat the Penguins.
Not looking good right now for Washington. One more here, Craig, before we let you go. I know you want to talk. You'd love to get into a full draft discussion, and we will absolutely have you on for that once we get a little closer, once the playoffs wraps up. But it is worth noting the draft lottery was this past weekend. New Jersey with 8.5% odds ends up with the first pick. Philly with the second. Just one quick take now that we have the results of the draft lottery. Your thoughts? I know you're involved with the Devils organization, so we'll just throw that caveat out there before you you start pumping them up. But one quick thought on the results of the draft lottery.
Well, at least it shows that there's a lot of talk about it being rigged, but it's completely not. I actually retweeted out the video yesterday of the actual lottery taking place, and you can clearly see Commissioner Gary Bettman was shocked and awed to find out that the Devils had the first overall pick, moving up from the fifth best odds up to the number one pick. What the draft is really going to come down to, especially the first two picks, will be Nolan Patrick and Heischer. But the most interesting one will be Dallas at number three and who they decide to take, because there's clearly the two top guys and then there's a bit of a drop off from them and they're both centers. So does Dallas go with the defensive player because they're trying to build up their defense and rebuild and get younger on the back end? Or do they go with another skill forward up in the drafts? So that's where the most interesting move is going to be and what I'm going to be looking forward to in the draft. But it really comes down to what GM Ray Shiro wants to do, whether he wants to take Heischer or Nolan Patrick. And the consensus around the hockey community is still Nolan Patrick will go number one.
Well, Craig, we'll have you back on once we get a little closer, both the expansion draft and the NHL entry draft. Until then, you can follow him on Twitter at CraigSeiden1513. You can catch him on Snap Call as well. Craig, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much, Alex.
Colin, it is a Snap Call Sports production. Snap Call Sports is available for iPhone or Android download. Snap Call, the game within the game.
And there's no secret, Paul Pierce is getting the basketball. Here it comes. Felton on him right now. Garnett the screen. Pierce driving on Stoudemire, the jumper, yes! With 0.4 of a second left.
Final shot, about a 2.5 second difference. They got it in Pierce's hand. Harrington talking to Pierce. And Joe DeRosa telling him to shut up. Pierce buries it, right in Harrington's face.
Shot clock is turned off. Celtics will try to go for the win. Pierce. Final seconds. Pierce puts it up for the win. Knocks it down. Celtics win.
Welcome back into Callin' It. Paul Pierce played his last NBA game over the weekend. The Los Angeles Clippers knocked out by the Utah Jazz. Alex Barth, Jimmy Young across the table from me now, our producer and Snap Call Sports sports director. Jimmy, not one of the all-time greats, and as a huge Paul Pierce fan, I'll say not Kobe, not LeBron, not Jordan, but one step below for sure, an outstanding career, one of the clutchest players we've ever seen, the most clutch player I've ever seen, was a consummate leader on and off the floor, and the game of basketball is going to miss Paul Pierce, at least from a player perspective. Supposedly he plans to stick around, front office, etc., but the end of an era.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. I mean, he was a great scorer. He was a slasher. He got the most out of his ability. He was a gamer. He came to play. He never really took plays off or games off. All of those things probably make him a Hall of Famer, okay? But he was not one of the all-time great Celtics. He was just a great player.
So we'll get into that. Don't jump the gun real quick. Just to recap, Pierce drafted by the Celtics in the mid-90s. Some just terrible, terrible teams. One of the darkest times in Celtics history in the post-Larry Bird, post-Lynn Bias fallout. Winning, what, like maybe 30 games a year during that span, the late 90s, early 2000s?
Yeah,
pre-Antoine Walker.
Yeah. Well, don't forget they lost Reggie Lewis, too.
And Reggie Lewis, that's right, another name. So players retiring, unfortunately, some passing away, guys they plan to build around. They bring in Antoine Walker. Pierce gets his first taste of success. Walker's gone. They have that year he broke his leg. I think they win like 21 games.
Yep.
And then they go out to get Ray Allen, Kevin Garnett, the big three. Paul Pierce captains that team to a championship. A couple more deep playoff runs. Only got the one ring. And then he's traded. Ultimately, his last great act as a Celtic is to bring in what we now refer to as the Brooklyn picks, a couple high draft picks, goes to L.A., reunites with Doc, and retires just shy of 20 points per game. I think his final numbers were when you round 25-3. But again, it's the off the court stuff too. You mentioned a gamer prior to his second season in the league, was stabbed 11 times, had a punctured lung weeks before the season, was the only member of that team to play all 82 games. And that to me tells you as much about Paul Pierce as anything else.
He's a true Celtic. Okay?
He really was.
He's a true Celtic because he set an example through his play.
We talked to Mike Reese earlier in the show and he gave an example of how Mike Vrabel truly is what it means to be a Patriot. Paul Pierce is what it truly meant to be a Celtic.
I agree. But you mentioned a couple of things there. That 2008 team with Garnett, Allen, and Pierce.
Yep.
Kevin Garnett was truly, in my estimation, the leader of that team. He is an automatic Hall of Famer. You can make a case that Kevin Garnett was one of the all-time great NBA players.
I mean, I think if it's not...
I don't
not,
think you can with Paul, that's all.
Well, I mean...
Not just, a bad thing, by the way.
Garnett, really quick, if it's not for Tim Duncan, probably the greatest power forward to play during his time in the league. Paul Pierce is competing with the likes of Kobe and LeBron, and like we talked about Jordan early in his career, but here's a guy who, let's say, 25 NBA franchises. He is hands down the greatest player the franchise has ever seen. He's maybe top five with the Celtics, and I know we discussed this a little before. You don't think so. I'd slot him in at five. A lot of players, I think, especially in this era, would have taken that, not necessarily in stride. They would have talked about, this franchise revolves around me. Paul Pierce wholly accepted that there were those who came before him who mattered more to the Celtics.
Right, and I think that definitely lends him to, you know, building on what was Celtics pride. You take pride in that uniform. You take pride in the work ethic that everybody in Boston as a sports fan expects when someone takes the floor, whether or on the field. People in this town, in this area, in New England, want to see 100% effort because they truly are living their sports dreams through those players. And they all feel like, hey, if I had that ability, I'd be working my fanny off to make sure that I could make that shot at the end of the game. The thing that drove me crazy, can I say it now?
I'm not going to say that Paul Pierce wasn't a great player.
He was a great player. He's probably a Hall of Famer. And this may not even be Paul Pierce's fault.
Here comes the old man yells at the cloud rant.
At the end of the game, they would clear everybody out, and they'd give Paul the basketball at midcourt. And
the step back from the elbow, automatic.
And no, it was not automatic. He did not make more than 50% of the game-winning shots at the end of his game. They did not. He absolutely did not do that. Well, he was not as clutch as everybody thought.
What about in the playoffs? He did not miss that shot in the playoffs.
How many times, granted, Paul Pierce was not in the playoffs every single year because of the type of team that he played on. He did not have the surrounding personnel. I get that. So at the end of the game, you do want the guy that is going to have the best percentage shot to win the game. Okay, in 2008, it wasn't Paul Pierce. It was Ray Allen. Ray Allen will always be a better
shooter
than Paul
Pierce. But then why did they give Paul Pierce the ball?
That, to me, is a coaching decision that was always wrong. They did it out of respect for him, not out of his track record. And if you would let me do a little research, I would have come up with some really good stats about this. But I have a decent memory about that era. And I'm telling you, it used to drive me crazy. That end of the game play, they would clear out for Pierce. He'd dribble the ball down to the last seconds of the game, or certainly the last seconds of the 24-second clock, and then he'd go one-on-one, and he'd do that little fall-away jumper, and I'm telling you, 8 out of 10 times, he misses.
Well, there it goes back to what we were talking about before. The leader aspect, that's why they gave Paul Pierce the ball right there, because he was a leader, because he was the heart and soul of that team. And I'm sorry, the step back from the elbow over Amare, over LeBron, over Wade, over whoever, Paul Millsap, automatic.
Well, it wasn't automatic as far as I'm concerned. I saw more games than you. And I'm telling you, I don't think, you know what? If you could come up with a statistic, okay, how many games did Paul Pierce win at the buzzer? I want as many buzzer beaters.
I will then
challenge you that John Havlicek had a much more clutch career and won more games on the last shot than Paul Pierce did.
Now, John Havlicek wasn't shooting over 6'10 small forwards like Amari Stoudemire.
I'm not.
He was shooting over 5'10 guys from Buffalo, New York.
I get it. It's always tough to compare different eras. I get it. All I'm telling you is, at the end of the game, the Celtics used to use this little, it was like the picket fence kind of a thing, double screen around the low post, and Havlicek could get the ball, bank it in at the buzzer, win, go home. With Paul Pierce, clear it out, let him go one-on-one, and try to make a shot. And I do not remember a majority. I think I said 8 out of 10. I think I was embellishing a little bit. I don't think he made more than 50% of those game-winning shots. Now, granted, in the regular season, okay, I'll give you that. Playoffs, I think he was clutch. You know, I'll never forget the game against New Jersey when the Celtics were down like 23 points going into the fourth quarter, okay? And I was so frustrated, I gave up on them. And when I got to the Revolution game, I found out they won the game. That was called reverse psychology. It works a lot, okay? Anyway, point being is they were gamers. He got everything out of his ability. He never left any of his ability on the floor. He knew that he was going to get a great act. You knew he was going to go out, pretty much score 20-plus points a game, which, by the way, is not an easy thing.
No.
It used to be done a lot more. It's not as easy as it used to be, and certainly not in his career. So I'll give him props. I absolutely will. I'll give him top 10 status in the Celtics.
Top 10. You have to.
I will, only because of his numbers, yes.
Well, he was a great player.
Yes, but
as the numbers reflect.
Right.
I will say this, for the number 34 in Boston, we're not going to see that number much more around Ortiz, Pierce, something about 3 and 4, and talk about clutch.
Who is 34 with the Bruins? They have the worst numbers.
Carl Soderberg.
I'm also thinking Carl Soderberg.
That was the last guy to wear it. I did that. I checked that. He had Shane Vereen with the Patriots. He was a decent player, but ultimately, I don't know about you, my favorite Paul Pierce moment, Game 7 against Cleveland in 08, the championship year. He goes to the line to put the game away. And there was a great piece a couple years ago, Comcast Sportsnet did, about Pierce's relationship with Red.
Yep.
And he just revered Red Auerbach.
Yeah.
He loved Red Auerbach. Pierce goes to the line, game on the line, needs to hit the free throw. You can tell by his face, he shoots it. The look on his face, like, oh my God, I blew the game. Bounces 5 feet up off the rim and goes in, and you see him
smile.
Just kind of exhale, and then in the post game saying Red tipped it in.
Yeah.
That to me is as Paul Pierce as it gets.
Yeah, no, but again, I think he loved his role as the star player on a less than championship caliber team year in and year out.
But let's not forget, he willingly gave that up. Yes. To go get the championship as well. He could play both sides of it. He could play the superstar. He could play the carry the team on the back. He could also play, you know, as Kevin Garnett said, Bleacher Report interview last week, we didn't care about the numbers. We put the numbers aside. We knew we had one job, and that was a championship, whether you scored 5 or you scored 50.
And that's why he was the true captain of that team. He was the leader of that team in 2008. Paul Pierce can wear the C all he wants, okay? Kevin Garnett made the biggest difference on and off that court because of who he was. You're talking, he was definitely, you know, guys you look at, Alex, and you say, Hall of Famer. You cannot look at the Celtics roster right now and tell me anybody on that roster
is a future
Hall of Famer.
There's some Celtics fans storming the doors to get to you about Isaiah, even though I agree with you, storming the doors
Isaiah
to get to you about Isaiah Thomas.
If Isaiah Thomas has the kind of year this year.
For
another decade.
Then we can talk. But
hallelujah.
So here's what I'll say to you about.
It reminds me so much of my favorite Celtic Tiny Archibald.
Tiny Archibald, I knew you were going to say that. real quick, because what you're saying about Kevin Garnett and stepping up, Sean Grandy tells a story that Paul Pierce, when he got named a captain early in his career, was walking around reading books on leadership because
yeah.
he wanted to know how to lead,
embraced
and he realized
the role.
He wanted to lead by example.
Right.
How many people in today's NBA, and we see it with all these super teams forming, it's happened in Golden State, it's happened in Miami, it's happened in Cleveland, the superstars get together and they can't decide who the voice in the room is and it sinks the team. Yes, Kevin Garnett was the voice of that team. Paul Pierce understood that.
Yep.
And he let it happen.
Right.
And I cannot think of an NBA player right now that would let that happen.
That's a great point, Alex. That's why I will absolutely give you that point, 100%.
Kevin Garnett was the heart and soul. Paul Pierce ultimately drove that team with quiet leadership.
And Ray Allen was a better shooter.
Before he blew it all up.
Before he blew it
all up.
But he was definitely one of the best Pierce shooters I've ever seen play basketball, and love to see him play.
Ultimately, Paul Pierce, the mother effing truth, according to Shaquille O'Neal, a great career. Supposedly, he's going to try to get a front office role with the Celtics. I'd love to see that.
You know, I want to just make one more point about the Celtics, and they have an advantage over every other team. You mentioned some of the younger teams that have the great players that are coming out now, and they're, you know, 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old players, and they get to a team like the Milwaukee Bucks, and they don't have anybody. The Celtics' tradition of how the fact that you can bury your ego for the betterment of the team plays into the fact that Paul Pierce bought into that, and like you said, Red was absolutely an influence on him. Now you have to worry about these young kids coming up that will not have that influence.
Well, that's why I'd love to see Paul Pierce end up in the front office. What Grosbeck said this morning, they will retire his number, whether it's a one-day contract or a front office gig, whatever. I'm sure Kevin Garnett's 5 isn't far behind him. And there's going to be
Bill Walton's 5.
Well, let's share. Well, Bill Walton gave it to Garnett. I think they talked about it. Just retire. Just put one of those squares up in the rafters. Just fill it in with tie-dye. And that could be Walton.
I love that. On that, like Lusky.
On that note, there's some good Celtics nostalgia coming. Not just for you. The 86 documentary was great. But now for my generation, we get to get nostalgic too. And hopefully there'll be more than just Paul Pierce as a part of that. That's all the time we have. We've gone a little over, Jimmy, but it's been a great show. One of our best shows so far. I want to thank you for hopping on the mic and throwing some Celtics old school knowledge on us. I want to thank Mike Reese, who came on at the beginning. An excellent draft talk with him. Craig Seiden, who we will talk to throughout the NHL playoffs, giving his input. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at Colnett Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes. We will be back next week. More playoffs. This has been Colnett, brought to you by Snap Call Sports. I am Alex Barth. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to Colnett with Alex Barth. This episode has been brought to you by Snap Call Sports. Snap Call, the game within the game. Available for iPhone or Android.